Hey there, podcast listeners. It's Courtney here with a special offer just for you. My new book is coming out in April. It's called Looking Up, A Birder's Guide to Hope Through Grief. It's all about grief and sorrow and the ways that birds and birding can bring us to a place of hope. It's a book of faith. It's a book of humor. We would love to give you a 20% discount. You can use this code, IVPPOD20. That's IVPPOD20. That code will give you 20% off and free shipping anywhere in the US when you order from ivpress.com. Pick up your copy of Looking Up, A Birder's Guide to Hope Through Grief today. Hope is the thing with feathers.
Hope is the thing with feathers.
That's like a bird.
Like a bird.
That perches in the soul.
That perches in the soul. Welcome to the Thing with Feathers podcast, a podcast about birds and hope. I'm your host, birding enthusiast, Courtney Ellis. Welcome back to the Thing with Feathers podcast. I'm your host, Courtney Ellis. So excited to have a fellow Wisconsinite on the show today. She is our first birder from Wisconsin. We've had a lot of Michigan birders. Our first Wisconsin birder of the season, Mary Gemignani. She is a data professional by day, and she is a hobby bird photographer. She enjoys spending inordinate amounts of time observing and photographing sandhill cranes. Welcome, Mary.
Thank you, Courtney. So glad to be.
Well, tell us a little bit about when you first became interested in sandhill cranes. They are really special birds. What first sparked your interest in these birds?
I just started observing them at local ponds. We have urban ponds all over Madison. And I just started observing them, and I thought, you know what? Not everybody has sandhill cranes. So we're in the flyway from the south of migration path. And I thought, I love sitting with them. They're graceful, they're beautiful, they're smart. And I just think that I would like to have them as one of my focus birds stick with them and observe them. I love observing birds. And so that's how it became. And I started getting gorgeous photographs of them. And not from a photographic standpoint, but from an emotional standpoint. These birds are beautiful, and they express a lot of emotion, and they show you a lot of behavior. So I just thought, well, I guess I'm called to just share crane photos, and as long as I can. And they're ample here. They're at most local ponds, and I enjoy it.
When we first met over Twitter, you and I have never met in person, but I just fell in love with your crane photos, in part because you get to know these particular cranes over a span of years. So tell us about some of the cranes. They migrate, right? And they come back, and you've gotten to know particular specific birds. Tell us a little bit about your particular birds.
Sure. There's about four main mated pairs that I followed. And for the last couple of years, and a couple pairs have been 3 years now running. And it's amazing that when the weather gets too cold, they'll migrate south. Some say as far as they need. A lot of people say they might go to Apache del Bosque. There's a number of places. I don't know where they go, but they always come back. It's like a miracle. And it's the same cranes come back to the same pond and try to mate and reproduce in the same areas. Their success rate is very, very low. But the first pair that I ever sat with was Rupert and Rufus. I don't anthropomorphize birds. I try not to. But the people at the pond were very excited. They named them, so I just honor them and call them by Rufus and Rupert. Now, it was a little bit sad this year. I haven't seen Rufus yet. So that would be really sad if he doesn't come back. But right now we have one crane there, and they just came back a few days ago. So we'll wait and see. The second pair that I have gotten fantastic photographs from is at the lakeshore. They hang out at one of the trails We have trails all over town, really beautiful nature paths, etc. And this pair hangs out at a nature trail trailhead by the university, and they're just gorgeous. They just come, they own the parking lot there. And in the summer after breeding, right now they came back. I actually got to see them land from migration. And so they came out of the sky and they were so high up. They did like a mile oval around the area a couple of times in a matter of minutes, seconds, and came down. And that was exciting to watch. Now they're back, but this weekend I couldn't see them much. They're on the move. So I think that they're real quiet and kind of elusive in the spring. They look for their nesting sites. It's cold, so they don't sit around too much in the sun or whatever. They're moving. So if you're going to photograph them, generally they're up, you know, grazing and walking around and things like that. And it's a little bit more difficult. So that's a wonderful pair. They have a huge green area. By the way, sandhill cranes love open green areas. And they just love it. And I wish that city planners would do a better job for them at the ponds. We can talk about that later. But the third pair that I frequently see is a pair that had a colt last year that was so special for me. And they're just at a local pond. It's a very affluent little community. They're a nice pond. And I got to witness how these cranes parent. And oh my gosh, it was just unbelievable. They are with their colt. They had two. One perished or got predated. And so that was sad, but one survived. And it was the very first colt that I got to document and spend time with, etc. They're back this year. Same spot, same birds. But they, you know, shooed the colt away. He has his own life now. He didn't come back with them. And he was just a beautiful colt. And then there's a fourth pair that I frequently go and photograph. And they're, I think, elder cranes. I think they've been around for a while. Another photographer that used to come up from Chicago to Madison, Alex was a really nice person. He's not on Twitter anymore. And he told me about them. He says, you know, Mary, they've had colts for years. They're always in the same spot. Go check them out. Take a look at them. And they're way on the north side of town, but I don't care. I go all the time. And they're always worth the trip. And they have a park that's kind of strange. It's on the backside of the Arboretum in Madison, which is a very big marsh right in the middle of town. And there's a park on the backside of that. And it's like just maybe 100, 150 feet deep. And it goes four blocks on the back. And the other side of the street, and there's a street, and the other side of the street is houses. But they just hang out there all summer. However, they're demonstrating the same behavior as a lot of the other cranes. They're on the move. You know, they look, I think even though they're older, they're looking for nesting places. And so the two times that I saw them, they flew away. And I was surprised because in the summer, they don't move. They hang there. They sit. They, you know, it seems like pose for pictures, you know. But right now, they're full of energy and life. And I think looking for a nesting place, even though they're an older crane. I only had the one colt last year. This pair didn't produce a colt that I know of last year, or I didn't see them nesting either. And hopefully I'll see them at the park again. Never know, it might be with a colt. They're just wonderful. And when I go photograph the colts, I'm always blessed and get to see a great blue heron, a great egret, a green herons, and a number of other birds. So they kind of hang together, and they're just all beautiful species, especially the crane. The crane can give you some poses that are unbelievable, and I just love trying to challenge myself and learn a little bit more about cranes and learn a little bit more about photography. And it's a really great way to spend some time on the weekends and evenings.
So which came first, your birding or your photography?
Oh, my photography is from when I was a child. I'm older now. I'm 65. And when I was a kid, I was a tag along with my next oldest sister, and she built a dark room in our basement. And she had hobbies all the time, really great hobbies. And this was one of them. And I kind of took a liking to it. So she let me tag along and taught me everything in the dark room. And we had the old film cameras. And it was a blast. It was a really nice way to learn photography. She was pretty good, but was all self-taught. And we took a couple classes and things like that. But I was only maybe, I don't know, 14 years old or so when I got my first couple cameras. I got two. I was a Nikon person. Now I'm a Canon person. All good brands. So there's a lot of good brands. Sony is the other really nice brand out there. But so that's when I started photography. Nature has always been in my blood. Always. So just some of the other... I never got out regularly, and I was never much of a bird watcher until recently. So the last 4 years have been really nice. It's a wonderful way to get outside. Birds are always everywhere. You just look up, like you say, and there they are. And doesn't matter what state you're in, doesn't matter, you know, what town you're in, they're there. And they're really a joy for me. And for me, the biggest joy in getting out birding is getting me out of the house and exercising and doing that little hike, even a little walk, whatever. But it's just really a joy. We have, I'm not a bird. A lot of birders are chasers. They want species, number of species, et cetera. And I just collect them as I see them. I never go for that. If I see a bird alert in my area that there's something unusual, I'll let it sit for, I don't know, months. If it's still there, then I might go, you know. But I don't chase after a bird usually. I'm kind of laid back. And I just enjoy it. I have my ponds I go to, and you can go anywhere. There's a wooded lot on the side of my apartment building. I'll go over there sometimes. And but you know, since you grew up here, we have a lot of large deciduous woods. And they're gorgeous. And you don't have that everywhere. So I, the other states I lived in, none of that kind of compares to, you know, the woods and the nature that we have here. So I appreciate it. Don't know if I'll always be here, but I am. And I always come back. Wisconsin's a really beautiful place.
I lived about an hour outside of Madison for a few years, and my husband and I would trek into Madison whenever we could. And one of the things I love about it is this bustling, thriving city, but it has so much green space. It seems like they're pretty intentional about preserving some of the wetlands and keeping some of the ponds, and there's Lake Mendota and just all of these beautiful, beautiful spaces. What are your favorite places to bird in Madison? You've mentioned ponds and lakes. Do they have names? Where can people go and spy on your cranes gently from a distance? We're not scaring any cranes.
Oh, sure. I go to Tiedemann's Pond. That's where Rufus and Rupert live. And then I go to Middleton, I think it's Hills, Middleton Hills Pond. That's where the colt was raised. That is a very kind of affluent Frank Lloyd Wright neighborhood. And it's gorgeous. It's a lot of fun to be in. And then I go to the lakeshore, at Picnic Point, usually. But there's Fritchie Point, there's Picnic Point, you know, you just find all kinds of things in that area. Hawks, a lot of hawks. And then the other one is Harvey Schmidt Park, where the elder cranes live. And so those are the four parks I generally go to, but I go a lot of other places. We have a place called, if you ever want to see hawks, we have a place called Perch Place. It's called Perch Place. And the hawks have been hanging out there for years and years and years on the telephone poles. There's an open park space, a county park space, on the other side of the road. It's very near the Lake Mendota. And they just hunt in that little prairie space there. And that's a nice place if you want to see one on a pole. I like to try to see them in a more natural space. And then also I like to go to the river and see the eagles at Prairie du Sac. Mm. This year was a bust for the eagles, so you never know what you're going to get. The river did not freeze. In order to see tons and tons of eagle, the river has to freeze, and then they go by the dam. There's a dam there, and then they'll fish in the open water. But the water stayed open, so the eagles flew wherever. But 45 bald eagles will get you pretty excited.
Wow. Yeah. 45 bald eagles. I grew up, we were talking before I hit the record button, I grew up in northern Wisconsin in a town called Eagle River. So we saw so many eagles, you know, my sisters and I as children, that they started to become less exciting. But I think I would still get excited for 45 bald eagles.
They're so far away for photography, and I'm always hoping to get a bigger lens, but I still enjoy going there. You can't beat watching a fish, you know.
Yeah.
Pretty darn exciting. So I enjoy the big birds predominantly, but I really love the little birds as well. I love all birds, and you won't see as many small bird photos from me, but it's just because I just spend so much darn time with the cranes. And we also have, there's one other spot that if anyone visits, it's called International Crane Foundation. It's in Baraboo, and they are protecting all the cranes in the world. So there's only 15 species of cranes in the world. They have all 15 mated pairs there. And so if something were to happen to a species, they'd be in a pretty good position to help. And then they have outreach communities in each of those native countries where the cranes live. But they have a beautiful facility. It's out in the county in Baraboo. And I need to go there this year. Last year, I didn't get there. And it's a really nice place for cranes. You know, the sandhill cranes are kind of like the low on the totem pole there. They have all these other beautiful, beautiful species that we don't normally get to see. But they are the authority if you want to know the endangered category of any crane. It's on their website. It's called savingcranes.org. And I've called them a few times for help on crane behavior and things, and they're excellent. So
That's a great resource to know about. I didn't know that was there. We'll link to that in the show notes so people can find it if they're interested.
Yeah, be nice.
Mary, one of the things I love about following you on Twitter is that you know, every photographer has their own style, and I can see in your photos the love that you have for these giant birds. I can see the time that you've spent with them. You know, these are not rushed, hurried photos. This is a labor of love. You have a lot of wonderful close-up shots. You know the bird's behavior and where to find them. So when you think about taking a photo, if someone's new, they're just starting to fall in love with birds, what advice would you give a new photographer? How do you learn to love these birds? How do you learn to be patient enough to get that good photo? How many photos does it take to get one of those great ones you put on social media?
Well, our cameras give us a lot of rapid fire photos, so, which is nice. But the real thing I would say to a photographer who wants to get nice is just spend time. Buy yourself a stool if you can and sit down. And just spend time with them, observing them. And then you'll see a lot, you know, I'm to the point where I can wait for a certain pose, you know, because I know when it's coming, kind of a thing. And just spend time with them. Their behavior, their lives, their beauty is just so interesting. You know, the habitats usually make a pretty good background for any photo. And just spend time with them. That's what I do. I bring my stool. I sit down. I have a wagon. I hate bringing a wagon along, but I refuse to put anything on my back while I'm birding. I don't want a heavy backpack. I'm older. I don't want to be going in and out of a backpack. So I have this Amish wagon, and it's beautiful. And I take that along and load that up with my stuff, my tripod or monopod, and I just spend time. And when I see a bird, I'll just park that thing. I'll sit down and just me and the camera and the bird. And that's it. And I do, I'm glad I convey that because I that's truthful. I really do spend a lot of time with them, and I enjoy it. And yeah, there's a lot of love. The last few years, I've been going through a lot of change in that. When you first go out and meet a big bird like that, or any bird that is frequent, you get emotionally attached to these guys. You know, you really do. And over the last 2 years, I've worked very hard to try not to get emotionally attached. You worry about them like right now. It's colder than heck out there. And at nights, and you wonder, what the heck are they doing? Are they going to make it? It's below freezing still here at night. And, you know, you start thinking about it, and you think, you know, they're out there, and they're going to make it. They're going to make it better than we would make it. I'll tell you that much. And so I don't worry. And I spend some time trying not to get emotionally attached to them, because you do. You really do. And when you spend that much time with them, you kind of have a vested interest in that bird. But I don't know. I've never lost any birds. I hope we didn't lose Rufus. I kind of feel like we might have. But so you just spend time with them. And that's the only thing why I don't get totally attached to them. I don't name them. I don't, you know. We have birds almost at every local pond in the city, I think. I just go to these four. They're very close. I live very close to Pheasant Branch Conservancy. Hmm. That's a nice place to go as well. 5 minutes away from me. And it's right down the street. And I like that. I could probably walk there or ride a bike or something. But I drive usually. Yeah. But it's a lot of fun. And just sit. Even with small birds are so elusive. They're hard. The larger birds are a little easier to photograph, and because they're slower. And so I still support the concept of bring a stool, because if you flush a bird, even a small bird, away from its area, it'll come back. It'll come back to that same area because it liked it there, you know? And I guarantee you they'll probably visit that branch again. Hmm. Sometimes not, but usually there's a pretty good chance that you're in an area that the birds will come to you. Hmm. It's fun.
So for people who maybe aren't familiar with sandhill cranes, they don't live where there are sandhill cranes. I'm here in Southern California, and every once in a while we get a vagrant, but they're lost. They don't live here. What sorts of behaviors do they exhibit? What do they act like? What do you notice them doing?
Generally, there's so much to observe. And I recently, my friend Janet Hill gave me a paper just this week on sandhills that a woman wrote who grew up here. And she logged a research paper at the university. It was so good. That was an excellent research paper. But otherwise, I learn on my own. I observe, and I'll use that paper for reference. But generally, they're very busy in the spring. They chill and nap all summer, and then they groom themselves up for fall. Mm-hmm. And they look really good before they leave usually. And but generally speaking, their behavior is never aggressive, by the way. They're mm-hmm. a completely docile, large bird, and they're so sweet. Oh, my goodness. They're usually in a submissive walk, grazing. They spend almost all of their time eating, you know, looking in the ground, foraging. They eat worms. They eat voles. They're opportunists. They'll eat things like that. And that's why you'll see red-winged blackbirds don't like them, because if there happened to be a nest they could reach, they would probably, you know, eat baby birds as well. So, but I've seen them eat voles and frogs and other things. But generally speaking, they eat tubers in the ground, roots, and worms. They love worms. And you would be amazed at your kids' soccer field how many beetles are in there. Because most of these ponds that I go to, there's a human feature. Whether it's a park or a soccer field or a baseball field, it's adjacent, you know. I wish, in my heart, I wish there wasn't human features at these ponds, but there is. So often I'll see them when they fed the baby colt crane. They were out in that soccer field all the time because they would eat them like popcorn. They were big beetles. It was like, oh my gosh, goodness, I didn't, it's mowed, you know, it's a mowed field. And I didn't realize how many beetles are in there, but there are. So they generally eat that type of thing. They love worms. So they're always probing with their beaks for worms. And, but very docile behavior. They graze for hours and hours. You wonder what the heck else they do. And the other half of their lives is they preen their feathers. And when they're not trying to mate or raise a colt. And, but they're extraordinary birds. And preen they do. They have special down feathers in their chest, and they're called powder down. And there's many kind of birds that have that. And they, as well as the herons, have it. You don't see those feathers. They're like, they are like powder. And they'll pull them out. And often you'll see a little tuft on a sandhill's chest. That's where they go get their down feathers. And they pull them out, and they use them to clean their other feathers with. It's a substance that helps them clean their feathers. So. And so that's kind of interesting. I've learned a lot about these special birds, and I love it.
That's fascinating. So they come with their own little cleaning apparatus. It's like built-in sponge. You just got to pull it off.
Yeah, sometimes you'll look at them, and it'll look like maybe even lice on their feathers or something. It's not. It's And they'll get it on their beaks, and you'll see sometimes when they're preening, they'll come up with, like, you'll see a picture that I've taken that has like little white fuzzy feathers on it. That's the down feathers. And it's fun.
That's so interesting. It's one of the things I love about hosting this show is we have professional ornithologists who come on, but we also have poets and we have photographers. And I think you need all of these different perspectives to really know a bird, because you can know a bird scientifically. You can know exactly how much it weighs and how many feathers it has and things like that. But you also learn things about it by looking through this camera lens with this particular care for them. And I love your perspective, because I did not know about powder down. I learned something today, but also I love the image of them on the soccer field pulling up the beetles, because there's almost something in their grazing. There's something equine, like there's something horse-like. Their babies are called colts. They have these long spindly legs. They're just such whimsical, beautiful birds. And now I have to move back to Madison. So I'll let you break the news to my husband.
Oh, I'm sure that'll go over good.
Huh? Well, Mary, you write a little bit about the beauty of Madison's natural spaces, and you've shared some of that with us. But on the other hand, you also mentioned we don't do enough for the birds when it comes to taking care of these spaces and other things. What more could we do for the birds?
Oh, make sure there's no adjacent human spaces. That would be the greatest thing. I would say after that, I would say outlaw fishing at urban ponds. These kids don't need to fish there. They're not going to eat the fish. And they end up with a bunch of hooks in the water and fishing line. That would be the second thing that I would say. The third thing is I would educate farmers that cranes are not bad birds. Leave them alone. They're on the rise. They're coming back, and they need some momentum. They will eat corn sometimes. But I think, personally, I met a couple farmers when I was out watching eagles one day. And talked to them for the longest time. They were great people. They were from up north, and they came down to see the eagles. And I said, oh, I generally photograph sandhill cranes. Oh, those guys, we don't like them. We like the foxes, and we like other things that eat our vermin, you know, in our fields. But they really do. They'll eat vermin. They come for the worms in the tilled field, too. You know, I don't think farmers always realize that. But educate people on what they eat, and they will eat vermin. They'll eat voles and moles and mice, and they'll eat all of that. So I hope the farmers can be kind to them. But generally speaking, we have an issue with our urban ponds, I think, because I think they're made. They're usually runoff ponds, you know, for the neighborhood water to go into. And we always put a people feature there, and it's not very safe for the cranes. We rush. It seems like they put all this natural foliage in there. You know, they'll stock it with goldenrod. They'll stock it with all these things. And because they think, oh, this is great pond stuff. Well, it spreads. In a couple of years, you have such a dense vegetation, all it has is a bunch of ticks in it. You know, you have a big tick-infested place, and then there's this human feature where all the kids play. And the ticks are all over the place, you know? And I have pictures of some really pretty flowers right by the playground area of one of my ponds. It's just loaded. These flowers are loaded with ticks. It's just like, I wouldn't let my kid play there if I had a kid. Oh, no. But I don't think they're architecting things right. I would say that we need, you know, quiet urban ponds that are well kept, because you don't want PFAS in there. You don't want them dirty. A lot of ponds around here do good things. They put water lilies in. That keeps them clean. A lot of different things. They try to do some good things. Some things I think backfire, like this really thick vegetation. And then there's this path. Well, the paths get used by joggers in town. You know, these urban ponds are just, there's too many people. You know, I mean, the birds don't like it. And the one thing the birds hate the worst, especially the cranes, is dogs. You know, they make it this dual purpose park and come walk your dog. And it doesn't always work out the greatest for the bird. And so I have, it's always going to happen probably. I would just say have a green space, but don't put any human features on it. Because big birds love green space. I've seen great blue herons loving green space. And you know, they all like it. But they're not going to use it if it's, you know, a bunch of kids kicking into the goal and, you know, that kind of a thing. They're not going to be around then. And then they just get a little stressed because, hey, that's our place. That's where we eat beetles, you know. What are you doing there? And so they cross the street. In this case, the family of the colt goes across the street and they go behind houses and they end up in a church green space. There's a big lot by a community church. And that's where they, if they want quiet time, that's where they go. Kind of fun. And, but we just don't do enough. And it's not a good mix usually. I especially don't like the hooks and other bad things for the environment that people don't realize. You know, they'll go to these ponds and it's very innocent. Let's go catch one of them goldfish that got dumped and then we'll just throw it back in and catch and release and stuff. It's just, I don't think it's necessary. I would love for them, if they want to fish, go rent a boat and go out in Lake Mendota in the deeper waters. You know, these ponds are, you know, a couple feet to 8 feet deep, maybe, you know, and they're just loaded with fishing line and pollution and hooks. And I think that the colt's mom might have had one in her mouth last year. I'm not sure. She has a little thing that hangs down, and when she bathes, she scratches at it just voraciously. And so fishing hooks are the worst for that kind of bird. You know, they'll get caught in their trachea, they'll die. And so I just hate to see that. It's a danger that they have to survive. So, I wish they did.
Mary for president.
Nobody's going to listen. There's always a human feature. And if we just think a little bit better for the birds, it would be a great day.
One of the things I've been thinking a lot about in talking to birders as I host this show is the effect that one person can have, you know, because I think someone goes fishing and they think, well, it's just one fishing line. Well, it's just one hook. And that can be the difference between life and death for one of these big, beautiful birds. Or we think, well, you know, I don't need to put window treatments on my house because it's just one house. It's just one window. But that, you know, to a migratory bird, that can be their end. And I think it can be tempting to look at the scale of a problem and think, well, I'm just one person, but our little bit can help as well. And I think the ways you're bringing attention to these cranes through your beautiful photography, you know, you're not out there yelling in the street, holding posters, you know, but the way that you bring this gentle attention to the beauty of these birds, I think is a voice for change and a voice for helping us to love them a little bit more. So I'm with you on the fish hooks.
Yep. And then I don't know what the solution is in trying to find the right balance, especially in an urban area with, you know, human features. We're always going to have it, you know. Can we do it smarter? Can we give the birds a space that is generally not touched or used for anything, you know? I don't know how to solve that one. I'm not a city planner. I'm not a, you know, a landscape planner. So I'm sure there's people that would have good ideas for it, though. But there's always a swing set. There's always a soccer field. There's always paths and a playground, or basketball hoops or something, you know. And I just wish they would have a little bit more quiet green space, because they actually just, they love their green space. If they choose during the day whether to be in that thick, you know, tick-infested vegetation or in a green space, they'll choose a green space every time.
Yeah, I don't blame them. Who wants ticks? I don't miss that part of Wisconsin. That part was not my favorite.
So you got to watch out for them. But, you know, just wear, I wear long pants, whether it's summer. I don't care if it's 100 degrees out. I wear long pants and plenty of shirts and sometimes a scarf. I try hard not to get any.
Yeah, I remember that ritual of my childhood was you go inside and you check for ticks. It's just part of it, you know, you check yourself, you check the dog. It's, yeah, we have our own rituals out here, which are things like prepare for wildfire season. That's not fun as well. No matter where you live, there's always something that you didn't really plan for. Well, Mary, one of the questions, we have two questions that we use to end the show, and I'm going to ask them to you anyway, even though I think I know the answer to the first one. Are you ready?
Sure.
What is your favorite bird?
That one's a no-brainer. So sandhill cranes, other cranes, and then the other big birds, and then all of the small birds. I love them all.
I thought I might know the answer, but you never know. Sometimes people surprise you.
Oh, here, that's it. That's it for me. You know, where are you going? Oh, sit with cranes.
Go visit my friends over at the green space. Well, second question, where are you encountering hope these days? Where are you finding hope, Mary?
Well, I think just trying to live your best life, no matter what the circumstances. Be hopeful for that. I'm older. I've gone through a lot of grief. I lost my parents. I don't have my parents, my grandparents, any of that. Now I'm at the stage of life where I'm losing cousins and things of that nature. So just be hopeful and live your best life, no matter what age you are, no matter what your situation is. I've been through a lot in my life, and hopefully I can write a memoir someday. But in the meantime, I'm working. I'm 65. I'm going to work till as long as I probably can. That's my financial situation. But that's okay. I mean, that's what it is. So I got to be positive through all of that. And just my hope just comes from probably, if I had to guess, you probably don't know this, but my other hobby is psychology. So my hope comes from self-love, I think. Mm-hmm. I really kind of had to nurture that in my life through hard times, through whatever, and always be there for yourself. If you have a family, there's others to think about. But love is usually a pretty good path to finding hope. And I'm not a philosopher. I love philosophy. I love psychology. But that's what I would say. Just we make our own brightness, you know, and we're the one that holds the key to whether it shines or not, no matter what the situation is.
Hmm. Well, Mary, thank you for the gift of your time, your beautiful photos. Where can people listening to the show find you if they want to see those beautiful sandhill cranes?
Oh, sure. Right now, I arduously do three platforms. So it's Twitter, and it's Instagram and Blue Sky. Twitter is still my main platform, even though people are kind of, you know, going by the wayside there with that platform. That's still my main platform. And the others, I don't spend quite as much time, but I am on there. And my goal is before I retire, I'd like to have my own site. So maybe I can sell a few photos and elaborate more on what I've learned about cranes. But that's where you can find me, just social media right now. And always happy to converse with anybody, especially on cranes.
Perfect. Well, I will link to your social media in the show notes and also those wonderful birding sites that you mentioned to us. And thank you for being with us today on The Thing with Feathers. It was a joy to learn from you.
Thanks so much. I appreciate being here.
The Thing with Feathers is produced by me, Courtney Ellis. Many thanks to Del Belcher for the music, to Todd Peterson for the name inspiration, and to Emily Dickinson for the beautiful poem and for being in the public domain. Until next time, my friends, keep looking up.
What does it go in your soul?
Yes, it does.